burning platform, fired up by Nando's on cliffcentral.com.
Better late than never, Justice, but good morning to you. We're always happy to see you. You know, you're a very big deal of the Thursday morning show. Thanks, and this guys. Is not just nice me saying it. Here, this is people saying it on you know on WeChat. You're in demand, sir.
I was just hit. Yeah. I was the first person to say it. I think.
Thanks, Ben. I wasn't sure about the song you selected, but hey.
Yes.
My choice of music, I think, is good.
That was Ben who selected that song.
So, just in case you're keeping score, Sia was 50 Shades of Grey, and my song was the Rally Ritchie song.
Okay.
Okay, well,
to each their own.
Yes, indeed. Justice, as always, there's a lot that we like to get through with you. But let's begin with a story that's now, you know, making the rounds on online publications all over the place. And I see that in Zimbabwe yesterday, there were hundreds of people who rallied and turned out for some other kind of protest yesterday over the shadowy disappearance of an opposition activist a year ago. His name is Idai Dzamara. I don't know if a lot of us are familiar with who this person is, what the story around the circumstances are, why these people rallied yesterday and got together over his disappearance a year ago. So, of course, you'd be the perfect person to ask in terms of providing the context and the information.
Thanks, Mabel. You know, I tell you, this is a story we should all be hopping up and down about. Itai Dzamara is a former journalist. He's an pro-democracy activist in Zimbabwe, had been agitating for Robert Mugabe to step down for a long time. So a year ago yesterday, he goes to get his head shaved, goes to the barbers, gets his head shaved. He's walking out, and a bunch of men suspected to be Central Intelligence Organization agents bundle him into a car, speed off with him. And that's it. No one's seen him since.
And all of this was witnessed, him being pulled into a car by strange men?
All this was witnessed, and people said, who are these people? What's going on? And he's gone. He hasn't been found. The police keep on saying, we don't know where he is. No one knows. For me, one of the first things that spring to mind is, there are two issues for me. The first one is, you know, South Africans, we need to be very grateful for the fact that you can say all kinds of nasty things about our leadership and so forth. We're not at that stage where people just disappear just like that. And you don't know where they are. There's no communication with their families and so forth. But, you know, that's by the by. But history teaches us that regimes that are undemocratic, that are despotic, do this all the time. So the history of South America in the 60s and 70s and 80s, whether it's Pinochet or whoever, all these guys used to disappear people. And by the idea of disappearing would be that, oh, you know, Ben's been saying or C has been saying all these things about the government and so forth. And so, you know, C would finish the radio show, would get out the door, and there'd be a car with some men, and they bundle him into a car and he disappears, and that's it. His family will never see him again. And there are hundreds, there are thousands of people in the 60s, 70s, 80s who were disappeared in South America. And to see this phenomenon raising its ugly head on this continent just across the border from us in Zimbabwe I feel we should be angry. I think South Africa should be up in arms saying, what's going on over there? I'm just shocked that Itai Dzamara was there one day and he's not for a year. No one will say where he is. Is the Zimbabwean government holding him? Why won't they find him? Why is he disappeared? The idea of disappearing people is one that I think, you know, South Africans should read a book. It's called Askari by Jacob Dlamini, and it's about the security forces in the 1980s who would kidnap ANC people, would kill some of them, and so forth and so forth. And we were going towards that. And I think the Itai Dzamara story is something that that we should all acknowledge. Zimbabwe is a basket case, and it's a basket case because stuff like this happens, because it's collapsed at so many levels. But I think this story for me epitomizes just how badly and how far down that country's gone.
Now, these protesters who rallied yesterday, among them Morgan Tsvangirai, have demanded that the president release some or other kind of information on Itai Dzamara's disappearance. What is the likelihood of that happening?
You know, it's Zimbabwe and it's Robert Mugabe. And Robert Mugabe has been in power for so long, he thinks he's God. He thinks he's king. He thinks he's there by divine power. So he's unlikely to release any information. He thinks that it's just okay. If he says it's okay, then it's okay. That's why he could, I think we sort of winked at this issue last week when he was being interviewed and someone said, when are you going to go? And he said, do you want me to box you to show you that I'm still alive? Mm-hmm. But for a man who's 92, is still going for another term in office, he thinks he's invincible and that he can just keep going like this. So it's unlikely. But Robert Mugabe now wants to reform the economy in Zimbabwe, wants the IMF to come in and talk, the World Bank to come in and talk. He wants to pay back some of the money that is owed to white farmers for taking back the land. So he might do it for purely selfish reasons that, well, you know, to get the loans that I need to get from the IMF and World Bank, I need to pretend to be a Democrat. So hopefully, for whatever reasons, he does it. But quite frankly, I don't think he's got the instinct or wants to do it at all. But it's Robert Mugabe. And quite frankly, if you think about, you mentioned Morgan Tsvangirai being at that protest. Morgan Tsvangirai in 2008, after he won the election, was arrested, beaten up, tortured. That's what happens. It's par for the course. So I hope Itai Dzamara is released, whether you like him or not or whatever. People shouldn't be arrested indefinitely without trial for a year when their family has no access, their colleagues have no access to them. It's shocking.
Justice, talking about getting economies right and bringing people in, let's talk about this whole Moody's rating
yes.
thing.
Yes.
Now, we've been chatting to, obviously, with Anthea and the Money Shot. So now is your chance to kind of educate us on this.
Ben, you have a lot of questions about these ratings agencies.
Okay, look, I'm quite cynical, but this is where I step aside and let Justice give us the final word. These rating agencies, here you've got guys with a big responsibility. They're about to say something and do something that's quite pivotal to an entire country. Now, in this day and age, we all know some things aren't final until, well, it's final. So what's going to happen with these guys coming out, and why are they actually visiting the country rather than just sending a mail saying, hi, you're junk?
Goodbye.
Ben.
Or regards. Hi, you're junk. Yeah. Regards.
You've been poked by junk.
You know, Ben, you make a very, very serious point. Remember that all those banks and all those banks that went belly up or were in trouble in 2008 with a global financial meltdown, all of them were essentially looking at young Sia there and saying, wow, he is so in debt. Let's give him more money. And so Sia kept on just getting more debt and more debt. And these people were getting away with it. And they, so long as they just kept on rolling over the debt and saying, oh, Mabali, do you want another house? And you can't afford it. We know you earned this little, but go on, have the credit. Go on, use it. And so it was crazy. And these ratings agencies did basically all those banks were AAAA, like amazing, they are fine, they are good, let them go on. And then you had those banks crashing, all that debt, and we had the global financial meltdown. And so these are not particularly credible persons. They are working hard now to say, no, we are fine, and we are still relevant. So questions have to be asked about these guys, because they got it totally, absolutely wrong in the 90s, where they basically didn't see that the banks and the major banks, whether it's Lehman Brothers, which went under, whether it's the UK banks, which just essentially gave away, just got people deeper and deeper and deeper into debt until the whole system collapsed. And they had to be bailed out by governments, the US and the British government and others. So you're absolutely right to ask the question. When they come here, COSATU and FEDUSA have already issued a statement saying, you guys, and I think it's Sipho Pamla, the COSATU guy, who said, you are the scavengers of the earth. And you come here and tell us what you... So I think that conversation will happen. Moody's is having a meeting with COSATU and FEDUSA. I'm not sure about AMCU and NUMSA and all the others. But that meeting is going to happen. The key thing, I think, for us in South Africa is to say, well, why are we doing what we're doing? Because at the end of the day, it's not about Moody's and S&P and Fitch. It's about whether we grow this economy for our own people. If this economy is not growing, Fitch and Moody's can say all these things, but at the end of the day, it's up to us. Our people need to be in jobs. Our people need to get, we need to raise the tax to build schools and so forth and so forth. So one of the things that is said is that we've become obsessed with, no, we mustn't become junk, instead of saying, no, we must keep this economy growing and being, you know, it needs to be fantastic and amazing and all these things. So it will be significant that Moody's is coming for our ability to borrow internationally, for the ability of our municipalities, our banks, and so forth to borrow internationally. And we have to acknowledge that we have to show them, tell them a good story, but to show them that actually we can deliver on all the things that we say. So if we say we're going to fix the state-owned enterprises, but we still keep Dudu Mieni as the chair of SAA, it's not going to be fixed, because she's responsible for getting rid of the board, getting rid of the CEO, the CFO, the COO, and running it like a little fiefdom of her own. So, you know, we've got to, these guys want to believe in us that actually you're going to do what you say you're going to do. Not you're going to say this and then go and do something else.
But essentially, it's about swaying opinions, right? Because, I mean, I didn't know this, but I discovered when Anthea told us earlier this week that, so you pay for the services of these credit ratings agencies. You pay them a fee, and then they come, they do their rating, and then they make a decision. But really, that decision is them formulating an opinion. And so the question that that Ben has been asking is, are there ways to swing which way these opinions go? Any CD operations behind closed doors? Because that's really, at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's formulating an opinion on us as a country.
It is. I think Ben wants to solve this problem by saying, I will up your fee. Moody's, thanks, but from now on, I don't want to pay you $100 per annum. I want to pay you $200 and let's see what your opinion looks like. Yeah. Unfortunately, in the wrong place at the wrong time. Because of the problems and the credibility crisis that the ratings agencies went through, they are quite keen to be seen to be independent and credible. So
I'm pretty sure that's what FIFA said when they were looking for the 2022 host.
We're very credible.
They might have. But I think your solution would be hard going, shall we say.
I think it was not so much a solution. I don't think that's where anything should be dealt with. But, you know, it's just finding out how these things work.
Yeah. Like, and that's how they work.
How much do countries actually assist them? So to speak?
If you're a bank, say last week you heard that APSA was downgraded, you know, and that our banks go up and down. I mean, our banks are still pretty much, but But Absa was a bank that was above the other South African banks in its rating, and now it's gone to a level that's the same as the other top four banks. So, yes, they pay a fee to be rated by these guys, because when it's good, it's great. If their rating is fantastic, then they can go to the Swiss and say, give me some money, and they'll get money at a very good interest rate. And well, you know,
that's what I was going to ask. So Pravin Gordhan is having meetings with like foreign money.
Yeah, yeah.
So now if he rocks up there and he's got junk status, does he not even get like a meeting request? Like nothing. It's almost like a rite of passage to getting a talk.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, so, Pravin Gordhan, okay, what's just a junk order?
And that's a big thing what Pravin is doing in the US and the UK, because if we are junk, many of the institutional investors are forced by their regulations to not lend. Basically, they'd have to say, you're now junk, give me my money. I'm pulling my money out now. They can negotiate it and say, oh, but they look nice. They have showers in the morning. They're such nice people. So let's see what happens. The regulations say, pull your money out, because you're investing other people's money, you can't play around with it. We've become speculative grade, and so that you don't play in speculative markets, and that's the big thing for us. So money would go out of the system.
So now, Justice, while Minister Gordhan is in London trying to woo foreign money, what, if anything, is being done to allay fears by South Africans who since last year have been taking money out of South Africa and taking it to foreign places? Because shouldn't, you know, I mean, seemingly these people are afraid of something. Shouldn't somebody be focusing their attention on them and saying, guys, please don't take your money out of the country? Is anything being done or said to wealthy multimillionaires and billionaires in South Africa who are deciding to take their money offshore?
And see ya.
Yes, and see ya.
Look, I think, I mean, that's a big problem. But at the end of the day, all this, I think to the point that Ben made, all this is about confidence. It's about saying to all those millionaires, billionaires in South Africa that, guys, this country has a fantastic future. You're going to continue to make money here. Look at the property boom over the past 10, 12 years. You can still make money here, and your money's safe here. If they don't have confidence, the reason why they're taking their money out is because they don't feel confident. So the key thing is that they look at Pravin Gordhan and say, wow, you know, now we've got a finance minister who's going to do some good things. What is needed is for, I was hoping we'd finish this program without getting here. But anyway, what we need is President Zuma to be seen to be backing his own horse. Unfortunately, and Pravin Gordhan made young people like Sia like to say, oh, he's throwing shade. So
yes, yes.
So the Minister of Finance gave an interview to some insignificant radio station yesterday, and he said, all we want is decency from the equivalent of a DG at the South African Revenue Service, basically saying Tom Moyane needs to sit down because he's not the minister. He's the equivalent of a DG. Mm. So if the minister says, you're going to stop the restructuring, Tom Moyane has no right to say no, but the former finance minister approved this, so I'm going ahead. And President Zuma says, oh, sorry, I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's not backing his horse. And people are saying, well, if he's not backing this guy who everyone says is amazing, what am I doing here keeping my money here? Because it might go belly up. So you need to build confidence. President Zuma knows what needs to be done to build that confidence. But unfortunately, he's not backing the horse that he's got. And that's a big problem.
Okay, we got a caller. Let's see, who are we looking at here? Sean. Sean, go ahead.
Hello, Sean.
Just a quick one. You know, we're a natural resources rich country, right?
Yeah.
We're struggling with employment at this moment. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse. Mm. I thought about this over the weekend. you know, I don't understand why our government don't reach out to the overseas market and say to someone, look here, come to our country, open up a factory, we're going to not charge you tax for the first 5 years. However, you know, the rules are that you have to employ local.
Mm.
For any guy out there, it would be amazing not to pay taxes in five years. And let's say after 5 years you get reviewed and you have to show a profit of X, Y, and Z. But local employment is a must. You know, it should be sort of a rule. If you look like places like Vietnam, that's what they've done, and it works. They're growing. You know.
Yeah, Sean, thanks for that. I have to say, incentivizing business to come and invest in your country is absolutely key. The Department of Trade and Industry over the past 6-7 years has spoken about investment zones. You're kind of, if you remember in the 80s, I come from a little place called Hammanskraal. There was a whole industrial zone in Hammanskraal called Babeleri, where you got tax breaks, you got all kinds of things to stimulate job creation. And I have to say, you know, young people like Sia here don't know what butter shoes were. But butter shoes were, you know, that they had a massive, massive factory in Lesotho, in Babeleri, in all kinds of places. And that was because we gave incentives to do that. Those guys, many of them paid very badly, but people had jobs. And that's part of the calculation you have to make. I think one of the problems we've had is that the trade union movement in South Africa has had some great successes, but has also stopped a lot of, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, Nelson Mandela and then Thabo Mbeki spoke a lot about IDZs, that's industrial development zones. But those were stopped by trade unions saying, no way are you allowing, for example, many of those were in these areas, there would be no unions. And so it would be no way is it happening. You know, one of the things that Qebisi Jonas, the current deputy finance minister, was very successful in was getting the automotive industry, so your BMWs, Toyota, and so forth, to come to the Eastern Cape when he was the MEC for finance there. And he got trade and industry to give those guys incredible offsets, and that's why BMW, all these guys are still in South Africa and manufacturing. It's because of the solution that you're talking about. We should be pushing it. It shouldn't be a guy like him alone pushing it in the Eastern Cape. But for the rest of industry, there isn't enough. So, exactly. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. That's the kind of thing we need. When you mentioned Vietnam, Vietnam did... You know, a lot of South Africans will sleep on a bed that's made with wood from KZN, and it used to be manufactured in KZN, and now most of the furniture you buy in all these furniture stores is made in Vietnam and brought back here with wood from KwaZulu-Natal. Why isn't that happening in South Africa? And it's because we're not doing that sort of thing to incentivize people to manufacture here.
Exactly. But anyway, so, or even legalize dacha and put it on the market.
Sean,
please, no.
Okay, Justice, let's talk about the president. Because he's away on a three-day state visit in Nigeria, correct? Sure. So why is the president in Nigeria, and how important is his trip to Nigeria?
I mean, we need to... I think that the relationship between South Africa and Nigeria has been... I've always found it fascinating. These are the two economic powerhouses. If you think back to Thabo Mbeki and Olusegun Obasanjo of Nigeria in the early 2000s, those guys went around this continent saying the wars must stop, Burundi needs to be resolved, and so forth and so forth. They achieved something amazing because, you know, the whole African renaissance, then Africa rising, our economies are going to be fantastic and so forth. And then over the past 5-6 years, the relationship with Nigeria just deteriorated. You remember we stopped some Nigerians from coming into the country because their visas were not right, and the Nigerians recalled their ambassador and said, "You people are terrible." When we had those xenophobic attacks here, the Nigerians were saying we're going to boycott MultiChoice and DSTV, and you know we're gonna chase them out of the country. Of course, I must say, the one thing that you can't police is what people watch. If they want to watch Generations, they're going to do it. And so the Nigerians were doing it.
But so it's like when the honeymoon phase ends and then you start bickering, you and your partner.
Yeah.
Are we now at the stage where we're going to counseling and we're saying, okay, baby, look, let's try and fix this.
Come on.
Is this what this is about?
We failed to go to therapy. So we went through all these terrible, terrible times. And if you look at what's happening with MTN, which has been fined humongous amounts of cash, it just adds to that kind of like, what are you guys doing to me? What are you guys doing? So what we're going through now is kind of, okay, I'd moved out. Moved out the house, taken my stuff. And it's like, maybe let's hold hands. Maybe let's talk. And so this was a good trip to make. President Zuma did good to do this because the relationship had gone too bad. And for those two countries to walk away from each other, when you have, you know, there are 120 South African companies, more than 120, South African companies, from your MTN to your ShopRite to so many operating in Nigeria. So it's absolutely key for South Africa to continue to keep that relationship working, for the animosity to be taken out of that relationship, and for us to be seen as partners. Secondly, I think that we need to actually encourage Nigerian business to invest in South Africa, because for too long, it's been one-sided, us going to Nigeria, being seen as, oh, these guys have arrived and they do this and they are a bit of a colonizer. And I think that's terrible. I know many South Africans are very skeptical about Nigeria. There are many myths about Nigerians are criminals and so forth and so forth. But I don't think that's reason enough not to open up this relationship even further. So I think it's been great. I must say, Muhammadu Buhari, the Nigerian president, banging on about MTN aiding terrorism by not registering those SIM cards was a bit undiplomatic. But I think those are some of the hoops one has to go through. But I like what's happening. I think it's a good thing. I hope President Zuma and others will just keep on making it work and work better.
Okay, so from a positive Jacob Zuma slant, let's go into Thabo Mbeki. I think you warmed up enough. Let's get into this.
I have to say, for me, so Thabo Mbeki, as usual, writes his letters every Monday to set the record straight.
Yeah, he's been treating us to, you know, a nice series.
I have to say. the question, and I think, Mabali, you asked this question when he first started, it's why is he doing it? And when you read this week's letter, you have to again ask, why is he doing it? Because one of the things about Thabo Mbeki and his... Thabo Mbeki is such a big brain. He's such a big wolf that just struts across South Africa. It's like, man, you've got a brain. But then he reminds us of just how bad it was sometimes under Thabo Mbeki. The fact that people were dying of HIV and the state was refusing to give them ARVs because Thabo Mbeki just believes that a virus doesn't cause a syndrome, and therefore this is, you're drinking the Kool-Aid of the pharmaceutical industry and so forth and so forth and so forth. So at the point where you know, in 2011, I wrote an article about how Jacob Zuma was so bad that everyone is looking around saying, Thabo Mbeki, where are you? Come back home. We love you. Come and, you know, save us, save us. And Thabo Mbeki's got that sheen around him that basically, man, you're the guy. You are the man. Let's come back. You're the big brain. And what happened this week happens. And you say, don't you have the what is it? That's sympathy, that empathy to just say, you know what?
Tact.
The tact, the... I don't know what to call it, but it's a tactile kind of thing that says, you know, let me stop and say, a lot has gone down in this country. It was very painful. It was terrible, and I just want to say I'm sorry. And the AIDS thing blighted my presidency very badly. If you think about Thabo Mbeki's presidency, there are two things: HIV/AIDS, Zimbabwe, and basically protecting Robert Mugabe. Other than that, I was thinking about it in 2008, December, when Thabo Mbeki was kicked out of office. The economy was growing at 7.1%. 7.1%. I mean, Moody's, Fitch, all of them would have been, guy, high five me. Let me give you more. I mean, we never spoke about it. The money was just ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. It was fantastic. Unemployment was at 20% from 26%. We were dealing with all these problems. So Thabo Mbeki, you look back on those years and say, man, you were doing the right things. And then this one. And I sometimes think, you know, the ability to walk away from something is an amazing thing. And Thabo Mbeki should have walked away from this one. But the key for me is still, why is he doing? Why is he doing it? He's... In fact, in just this 1 week, he's managed to reverse all that. And it's almost like, well, you know, when Gwede Mantashe got on into that car and drove at 3 a.m. to Mahlamba Ndlovu to say to him, my brother, we are recalling you. You kind of like think maybe he had a point.
It's interesting because when he first started his series of letters, people were, you know, they were confused. They were thinking, why is this happening? And then they, you know, we became used to the letters, and then people were thinking, oh, I can't wait for the AIDS letter. We have to see what he says about in the AIDS letter.
Yeah.
And now he has said something, and, you know, people are saying, but you've done yourself a disservice, actually, because you're not owning up to your mistakes, which is, I guess, all we wanted was for him to own up to the mistake and to say, it was a mistake, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So now it actually makes him look worse off than when if he hadn't said anything at all.
Exactly. I just think it's one of those, you've got something here and you're trampling on it, because Thabo Mbeki had reached now almost angelic status, and now everyone's talking about that Harvard report that said, you know, if you take those policies and link them to the people who died. There's 300,000 people, 330,000 people, who can be linked directly to the decision, to the policy not to provide antiretroviral drugs to people. And that is a damning thing on his head and on his administration, and all those things about, oh, beetroot and garlic and all so forth. You know, it just brings it all back. And I feel sad and angry for him that you could have been state manlike about this, and you missed again an opportunity to do good.
Okay, well, Justice, the National Press Club have now come out today. They've named the big news story of the year for 2015, and they unanimously decided that the Fees Must Fall movement was the big newsmaker for the year 2015. And I remember, you know, at some point along that movement, a lot of us as civilians found ourselves being very understanding of the students and what they had to say, and even, you know, supporting them and saying, yes, look at these young kids doing something great. But since the year has started, I think less and less South Africans are still supporting the students, you know, because of the direction that these student protests have taken since the beginning of the year. Yeah. So let's have a look. Let's analyze and dissect these protests and how they've changed since the initial movement started, and then ask some tough questions about what needs to happen next.
Yeah. I think there are two things, and I've been interested. There was an article written by the editor of the Mercury newspaper down in KZN. He's a Joburg guy, used to be at the Star. Fikile Ntsikelelomoya wrote a piece saying, what exactly is next? Because it seems as if everything must fall. So what do you want in its place? And it's a philosophical inquiry into what is this. So fees must fall, and so, you know, the fee hike was frozen for last year, and then it's Afrikaans must fall, its roads must fall, there's a lot of falling, but what must stand in its place? Do you believe that the fall of Afrikaans, is it replaced by the rise of Sepedi or Setswana or isiZulu? What is your vision of the future? What is your vision of where you want to go? And that is one of the things that has left a lot of people worried. So at the University of, let's say, TUT, and you take particularly Sosha Nguve campus, which is all black, kids are not going to school. People have been told to go home, come back next month or the month after, and so forth and so forth. And so, well, that's great that you're fighting for insourcing, but what are you saying will stand when you're done with this? So that question is becoming more prominent about what is next for you. What are you calling for? And I think that's a question that needs to be asked, because at the moment there are so many elements to this movement. It actually isn't a movement anymore. It's whether SIA can do something here and somehow, on the coattails of the Fallist movement, say, no, I'm part of that movement, but actually he's pushing his own agenda. And so that is being questioned. The other thing is, for me, the idea that much of the debate around the fees must fall or Fallist movement is, what are the ideas driving this? Because it sounds increasingly like it's about identity, not ideas. It's about, I'm black, and therefore I'm right. Not about, well, what is the idea of non-racialism? Should we be revisiting that? I'm not sure that it's driven by ideas any longer. What are the philosophical underpinnings of this thing? Because just because I'm black doesn't mean Sia and I agree on everything. Mm-hmm. Just because President Zuma and I are black doesn't mean that we agree on everything. And so just resorting to identity is just not enough. It's not nuanced enough. And we've seen it with the PAC, AZAPO, that identity politics are just not enough. You need to have a bigger view of the world that goes beyond just identity. And so I think we're going through a period now where philosophically the Fallist movement needs to step up and tell us what exactly it is and what it stands for and what its view of the future is. But also that its tactics are just plain wrong. The violence, some of the deeply racist stuff that has accompanied their protest and their failure to condemn it. The fact that they themselves are divided. If you think about the Fees Must Fall movement and what happened at Wits, it was a conglomeration of Progressive Youth Alliance, of EFF Student Command and others. But now it seems as if it's just EFF Student Command and some other forces that are not one united force. So I think it's a pivotal time for that movement to begin defining itself a little bit more clearly. Otherwise, it's certainly losing many people who identified with it in the past, in October, November, December. And it risks becoming a fringe group that throws a petrol bomb at the science center in University of the Northwest, and people say, what are you on about? Because that's your center.
And that's my children's center who are coming after you.
Exactly.
Once you've left.
Just destroyed it.
Yeah.
For what? On what basis? And so I think there's been a lot of damage done to that movement by its own people. And its failure to call them to order. One other aspect of it is the glamorization of violence that in a country where 62% of the participating electorate voted for a black government, the ANC government, that you think that burning and destroying property is and using violence is legitimate. It's not legitimate at all. This is not a repressive regime. We started off talking about the fact that you, me, all of us here, and some of the things we say on these shows and other platforms, that in repressive regimes, we wouldn't be. Yeah,
we'd all disappear one by one,
and so to actually say the ANC government should be confronted by violence is obscene in the extreme. This is a great democracy, and the freedoms we enjoy are amazing. So the violence is totally unjustified.
Well, Justice, I think we have to wrap it up there. I think we've had you for, this is the longest we've had you. It was quite something. But it's cool, we finally got to go through all the topics. Now, if you didn't know, Justice basically prepares the show, I think, more than any of our other guests. Well, he does by a long way.
Definitely.
So we get the topics, and we just try to tear up and let him go. And go you have. Thanks, Justice.
Thanks, guys. It's been great.
So, same again next week.
We'll
be here. Gareth won't be, but you know.
I love you guys.
We love you too.
We love
it as well, Justice.
I think we should. Should we just tell him to stay away?
He can stay.
Well, he's buying himself very expensive tequila, so he might not come back anyway. Gareth might be the most deaf in America.
Cheers, guys.
Well, Justice,
thank you.
Catch you back next week.
Sure. Bye.
Burning Platform, fired up by Nando's on cliffcentral.com.